Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow, but today I'm not alone. Today you'll be in good hands because I have a real historian on the show. Not just that, but he's actually a professional history podcaster too. So how did I finagle this, you ask? I just subscribed to his VIP membership feed, and I guess the membership includes guest appearances. So how cool is that? Now, the podcaster I'm talking about is none other than the host of the History of podcasts, like the History of Hannibal, History of Alexander, History of the Arab Spring, and recently started another that I highly recommend, the History of the United States podcast, Jamie Redfern. And welcome to the History of Germany, Jamie, and thanks for coming to the show.
Hi, Travis. Thanks for having me.
I'm loving your current, VIP membership feed for the History of the United States podcast is you're covering the Aztecs and like the early history to the, you know, it's ongoing, so I don't know how far you're going to go, but that's really cool too, and I would also recommend that. It's definitely a great show, both of them, you know, your normal feed and your membership feed.
I appreciate that.
Sure. And you should be aware of one thing. So on this show gets translated into German. So everything you say will be translated into German.
Oh,
just,
wow.
Just so you're aware.
That is fantastic. I didn't know that was part of the deal and coming on.
Yeah. And that's, another thing that I think is really cool is because I do this in German, I always wondered what does my German audience think of an American doing their own history in their own language? I mean, you know, I just can't imagine, really. But so I appreciate the fact that we have a Brit doing the history of the United States, because it's kind of, you know, it makes me feel like, okay, maybe there's some patriotic biases we might have that if you just have somebody that's not an American doing it, that just avoids a lot of those issues. So if anything, I think that's a plus. I would recommend it, your show, even more because of that.
The only downside is missing out on like culturally things that like all Americans know, like Roanoke.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is a huge deal, except I'd never heard of it before I started doing the research, and I'd only seen it written down, so I did my first episode about Roanoke, because I didn't know that he was silent, and I've got so much flack from so many people about that.
Like, how could you not know this? Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I have the advantage that German is pretty phonetic, so I actually have less pronunciation issues in German than I do in English.
But that's always handy.
I am always paranoid of the same thing. Like, I'm just like, oh, I'm missing out on so many jokes here because I don't really watch that much German TV, or I'm in California now, so I can't just like go down to that local museum and, you know, or that battlefield and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's that painful aspect of it. If you were here, you just, you know, go down to Virginia and start, you know, jump in your pickup truck or car and start driving around. But okay. Now, up until now, or the last few episodes, I've been talking about the German-Roman relationship, which I thought I would get through very quickly, and it turns out this is, I don't know, episode 8 on that already. So we covered some of the kind of Romanization of the Germans and the conversion of, you know, conversion to Christianity of both Romans and Germans, because in some cases that happened pretty close to each other. So I want to kind of continue with that and then kind of look like, or, you know, get a view of what this relationship between Germanic peoples and Romans and the Roman Empire and all that looked like kind of right at the cusp, right before the Great Migration and when it all started to fray and crumble. And you're the perfect person to have on the show because of that, because you just wrote your thesis on part of that at least. So now I really want to talk about, okay, so, you know, all these Germans are migrating, I guess. And now, how did Rome react to this? Because they changed their strategy, just how they defended themselves, their infrastructure, their military, all this changed pretty quickly. At least, you know, every couple generations, you could say that there were major differences in the way it was run before.
Mm-hmm. You've got a constant trying to improve.
Yeah. And so I've had a read through your thesis, and that was just incredibly fascinating. I guess my first question for you, or what I would start with, is way before. So what was, like, if you could paint a picture of what was kind of Romans' idea of defense before they had any issues with Germanic peoples, and what did that look like when Rome was stable, let's say?
Okay. For the very beginning, like when Rome begins to deal with the Germans, they have the perspective that the best form of defense is offense.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that with dealing with the Teutoburger Forest and their constant attempts to annex Germany.
Yep.
But when that doesn't work out and they stop expanding, they have a bit of a hegemonic imperial system where you have the core imperial provinces in the center. You have Italy, you have Gaul, Greece. And then that's surrounded by that is a string of client kingdoms. So the idea is the client kingdoms can deal with the threats from further afield. They can control local policing. And if there's a big problem, then a central army stationed at a key like nexus in the empire can strive mm-hmm. out and deal with it.
Yeah. So what time period are we talking there?
This is the Julio-Claudian period.
Yeah. Okay. And then obviously at some point that stops kind of working out so well for them. Okay.
It's very untidy because you've got all these different client kingdoms, and the Romans, they like to have things organized. It's too crazy for them. So mm-hmm. they start annexing, they start making the frontier a lot straighter. There's ideas of a scientific frontier, like what's the best frontier we can manage. Mm-hmm. So during the Antoninian period, you get a perimeter defense. This is Hadrian's Wall,
right.
Where you've got the limes, which are defensive networks. And the idea is that Rome uses those as forward bases to try and crush a rebellion before it exists. That way the civilians within the empire are better protected.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's this that this perimeter defense, these strong borders, are the is a lot of my focus in the last couple episodes. If you think of there being a strong Roman border, but there's also a lot of trade. I mean, I think the more I read about even like Hadrian's Wall, if you know, the more recent research is saying that it was really porous, and there was a lot of back and forth, and a lot of until there was an attack, then they closed up shop. But there were people living on both sides of the wall, and it was still a gradient of culture and trade goods that you could find, you know, for miles and miles away.
I mean, it definitely wasn't something to hide behind. It was mm-hmm. something to like project Roman force
yes.
outwards, project culture.
Yep. And so this is yeah. And so I was trying to paint the same sort of picture that now we're looking at. The Romans thought of themselves as, okay, you know, the west bank of the Rhine is ours, period. And the south of the Danube is ours. And in between the two, they still had client kingdoms. But, you know, those two borders are easy to defend and nothing gets through.
Mm-hmm.
And but on the other side of the border, there, you know, Romanization happened for a good, to simplify, I guess I'd say a strip of land that's a good, you know, 200 to 300 miles wide. And we see Germanic tribes emulating, Roman towns starting to... Well, first of all, they didn't really have that many towns before. So they start building towns and, you know, emulating them on a grid and trying to build as close to Roman towns as possible. And it's just really interesting. So then you see this spread of Roman influence in a way. So it also wasn't a definitive border. It wasn't like outside the wall are barbarians and we never talk to them and we fear them. No. It was like that's there's good money to be had out there. Let's go trade and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what were the problems with that? Why did that system start to kind of crumble?
The problem is with that system is like it's a better system than what existed before, mm-hmm. but it's very fragile because by moving all the forces of the Roman Empire from the interior to the exterior along the perimeter, you lose a reserve. You can't deal with a threat. Like, if a force can punch through that perimeter, then you've got a huge problem. You don't have anyone to deal with it.
Yeah. And that's already foreshadowing a lot. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
That sort of is where everything really falls apart with that.
Yeah, and now I know we're jumping ahead a lot, but just to kind of keep this together, to kind of follow the... I like the way you had it laid out in your thesis, actually. So now, you know, even after the Great Migration period, even after the crumble, so how did they deal with that? How did they, you know, how did Rome adapt or change to that?
They thought that the best way to deal with this is to sort of reintroduce depth. Like, client kingdoms start becoming more of a big deal in the 4th century. There is Edward Luttwak's famous defense in depth theory, where I think the Roman military isn't what you'd think of as the Roman military anymore. Like, there's no classic legionaries with the big square shields full of armor. What you have is a string of, like, part-time peasant soldiers on the frontier, the Limitanii. And then there are interior field armies, the Comitatantes or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Latin can be a pain to pronounce. Yeah. And then they... So the frontier troops will try and bog down any invading army, and then the Central Reserve will come in and save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Except that while it allows the Empire to continue, that tends to lead to a lot of invasions, which... Yeah, leads to all the Germanic invasions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and in your thesis, you know, just kind of in my mind, I always wonder, like, why did Rome fail? How did this happen? And of course, there's a myriad of reasons, and it all kind of comes together. But you know, the obvious flip side to that is, well, but the Byzantines were okay for another 1,000 years. So what was different? What did the Byzantines do different?
That is a very tough question. The Byzantines had a few advantages that the Romans in the West didn't really have.
Okay.
I think that the attacks were less focused on them. Like, they were better able to absorb the shock, I guess.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So part of it was just a roll of the dice kind of thing, where they were,
And I guess you'd have to say a lot of it is the location of Constantinople. Yep. Where that city is just so easy to defend that had Rome or Ravenna or Milan being anywhere near as brilliantly strategically located as Constantinople, maybe something could have held out, but...
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, another couple of things that I gleaned from your thesis is that I didn't really know. So, because I still kind of thought of... I mean, I guess I knew this, that in the decline, it's a very different Rome, but I still would think of, no matter what, Rome had these mighty armies. Maybe they just failed tactically now and then or whatever, but the fact is that kind of by the end of the Roman Empire, just recruitment itself was a huge struggle, and especially in many provinces. So that's kind of... Recruitment can be different in one province versus another, which was, you know, something I hadn't really thought of. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I thought was interesting. That I think maybe did I get this from your thesis or somewhere else? But even to have a 2% of the population in the military was hard for them to do, basically.
Yeah, that was in mind that there's a population of about 50 million people. In the Roman Empire, and that the largest possible army they could support was 500,000. So they couldn't get above 2%, but a lot of the time it was even smaller than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, in fact, they weren't really defending, or they weren't really depending on themselves so much, which, so first of all, you know, we have mercenaries. We have them just paying barbarians to fight their wars for them. But then another thing that I kind of wanted to break down a little bit on this episode was, in your thesis, you mentioned federati. And so I know about, I kind of knew how client kingdoms worked, and I've been reading about it for the last few episodes. But give us some more details there. So, because even the Latin term federati, so it's a really old one. They've been using it forever. But we're kind of talking about what did you say, fruitus in iniquum? My Latin's horrible too, but kind of an unequal federation or, you know, client kingdom. So yeah. The Romans were definitely the dominant partner in this arrangement. And if I remember correctly, the client kingdoms had to go to war if Rome made them, but not necessarily the other way around. Is that what made it unequal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. There's another type of equal alliance where Rome would have to go to war for the other person, but those don't really exist from about 500 BC onwards.
So what would have been an earlier example of one?
Probably something along the lines of when Rome was a city-state, relationship it had with the Latin League, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah, I think, yeah. So, yeah, they would defend each other equally. Yeah, that makes mm-hmm. sense. And now this is, you're going to love this one. So, because this is a crazy question. This would be, you could write a series of books on this. But what part of the collapse of Rome is internal, just kind of rotting away from the insides for various reasons? And I know there's a million reasons. But then also, what part is kind of the invading Germans being pushed by Huns? And so what part's internal, what part's external? If you had to give a percentage point to that, what would you say?
If I was to put it as a percentage, I would say maybe a third external and two-thirds internal.
Okay.
I think it's definitely an internal thing.
That's interesting. So so if they would have had their act together, even just a little bit more, they could have hung on and probably outlasted the Huns and been okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a bold statement that's the end of the end of study on Rome.
I wouldn't argue that because there are just so many problems at this point and. There was that theory. I don't even know if that's still valid. I kind of think not. But someone wrote a book saying, well, you know, the Roman Empire collapsed because they used lead pipes and they all just went a bit daft after a while or, you know, had lead poisoning.
Yeah, that's still in there. That's still, I think.
One of 100. Yeah, I'm sure it's not emphasized so much anymore. It's one of 100 reasons, maybe. But yeah, I mean, there was just the way that the society functioned and their government and everything was kind of more and more splintered, less and less centralized infrastructure. Although actually infrastructure, it's interesting that Rome had good infrastructure and still, I mean, that's the thing. There's just so many things that had to go wrong for them to collapse. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, okay. I think, yeah, that's interesting. I'm sure we could talk about that for
hours
another 10
hours.
Yeah, or even 100 episodes. In fact, I would say, hey, go listen to the History of Rome podcast and, there's a bunch of others out there. So we don't need to talk about that again. I would like to talk about the invasions from the kind of Germanic point of view or what that looked like. So I guess my first question is it was really common for some of these Germanic tribes to be formalized Roman federati. Is that true? Or were they really, completely independent, completely on their own?
It varies. You get some...
There's a spectrum, I guess.
Generally, what happens is that with the big 406 invasion, those tribes aren't Foederati, but they become Foederati later on.
Mm-hmm.
After the invasions have all played out, like at the about 418, things begin to settle down a bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then they're kind of sub kingdoms of. I mean, then we get even weirder. I'll give examples in later episodes of Germanic of Germans really claiming to have Roman authority and just trying to continue on the Roman Empire even though it's German government and German military, German tactics, but they'll take the local title or whatever. It's clearly a huge range from completely independent to Germans that think they are the Roman authority basically.
Yeah. So one of the a little quirk I like is to do with in the mid the 450s when you've got one of the Gothic kings, he's dealing with court and it's being described by a Gallo-Roman aristocrat called Sidonius Apollinaris. And when he's describing the Gothic king doing whatever, he's describing a Roman magistrate – and the account is like a copy of Suetonius describing one of the Roman empires, or Cassius Dio dealing with Septimius Severus. Like, the words he's using are exactly the same words you'd use for a Roman Roman magistrate.
Yep, yeah.
And it's all within that world.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's a barbarian king and he has nothing to do with Rome.
Yeah. I've obviously mentioned the Goths before, and we talked about their conversion to Christianity and that in a former episode. But I never really introduced them. So this is this could actually be a lot of fun. Would you like to help me introduce the Goths to the History of Germany podcast?
Like, I would love to.
I've actually been looking forward to this for a very long time. So it's cool you're here. So who are the Goths, Jamie? Where did they come from?
Where did the Goths come from? That is a bit of a mystery.
It
seems to be some place in Northern Europe, around the Baltic, maybe Sweden, maybe they come from the Ukraine, but somewhere in Northeastern Europe.
Yeah, we could go back to legend.
Oh, there's plenty of legend around the early Goths. If you get into, like, Jordanes's Getica, he describes the Goths having adventures, like, in 1000 BC with the Egyptians, they're fighting at Troy.
I saw those. Well, actually, a lot of Germanic tribes had ones like that. I found the same thing for the Saxons and the... Oh, geez, what was it? So the Saxons claimed that they were fleeing Trojan, they were descended from fleeing Trojan refugees. And the Franks was something else, like they were, descendants of Alexander the Great's army or something. But, they do tie it back to classical legends and stories if they can, even if they can't, they will, they'll try.
There's a way.
Yeah, and there's another kind of, I guess the most famous origin myth is the Gutsaga, which relates kind of when they, and that's the question, is did they, why, did they come from Gotland, or it's really not clear where they originated from, right? Like what part of Sweden? Because in Swedish history, they're from either, there's a... an island, Gotland, if people are kind of geographically challenged. And it, just kind of got too small to support them. And then they perhaps spread out from there. And so the Gutsaga describes this. I'll give you one little quote here. It says, "Over a long time, the people descended from these three multiplied so much that the land couldn't support them all. Then they draw lots, and every third person was picked to leave, and they could keep everything they owned and take it with them, except for their land, obviously. They went up the river Dvina, up through Russia. They went so far that they came to the land of the Greeks," okay, which is, all right. "They settled there and live there still and still have something of our language." If they mean that they went to, like, the Crimea and stuff, yeah, that's true. But, so, and I guess it's also kind of interesting to note that there are similar Germanic tribes that, even the Vandals, perhaps, followed a very similar path. Kind of from southern Scandinavia into Pomerania, which is now northern Poland, basically, and then south into the Ukraine, and that's where they were kind of at the beginning of the Great Migration, and then they all moved again.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you. Okay, so when do we start seeing Goths really showing up in Roman sources?
They begin to appear in the middle of the 3rd century. This is when they start moving southwards from the Ukraine. They begin causing problems on the edge of Dacia, and then, like, raiding in Greece and around the Black Sea.
It's kind of unfortunate that, again, the Romans, that makes me think of the Huns. Like, the Romans don't really talk about them until they're right there, until they're just up against their borders and like, oh, crap, there's this whole people we didn't know about. And they're right on our borders. Who are these guys? Yeah, that's too bad. I feel like I wish Romans would have gone out and explored a bit more, because Ukraine's not that far from where they were. So in the Ukraine, this will be a future episode. I'm definitely going to talk about kind of the linguistics about with Goths, because for the most part they died out. It's an extinct branch of the Germanic language, but there's Crimean Goths that stayed put up until the, what, like 18th century or something? Have mm-hmm. you heard of these guys?
No, I don't think I have, actually.
So they were really, I think the religion might have been just regular Russian Orthodox by this point. Uh-huh. But they were noted for, they kind of lived in their villages, they were kind of segregated, and I can't remember exactly when they were gone, but they were for sure there in the 18th century, probably the 19th century, and then, you know, through one Russian policy of another, they were just finally, you know, or maybe when the railroad came through or when the harbor was enlarged, and they just were just absorbed into the rest of the population. But Crimean Goths, so they were, you know, they were there from before the Huns. They kind of stayed out of the way by being in the Crimea and were there until, you know, just kind of stayed put. So I'm but the sources on, so even that's the unfortunate part, is that they disappeared right before people were really interested in linguistics and started to really, really write this stuff down, like in the, especially in the 19th century. And so right when, you know, so they disappeared just a generation or two before people really were interested, like, wait a minute, you know, there's these stories of these Goths in the Ukraine or in Russia, and yeah, but they're gone now. And, you know, so it's kind of a sad story, actually, because we could know a lot more about the Gothic language. I mean, I'm sure it evolved over 1,500 years or so, but still, yeah. So I'll talk about that later, too. So, yeah, some Goths did kind of end up staying put. And so, yeah, now we actually, this is another interesting part of Roman history, because we're talking about the time of Constantine the Great.
Mm-hmm. Because the Goths were very friendly with the Constantinians. They sort of moved into Dacia when the Romans mm-hmm. withdrew, and Constantine, he sort of launched a campaign against them, but then he made peace, he let them trade. And then to keep an eye on them, he built a bridge across the Danube.
Yes.
And it's insane, this bridge.
Yeah. So, yeah, I did a whole episode just on Julius Caesar's bridge when he crossed the Rhine. And then when I looked this up, I was like, oh my goodness, this is, yeah, even more impressive. But yeah, that's important. So he built this, especially, you know, the Danube was the border. So by building this huge bridge across it, that's actually hugely symbolic, even, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, but it's maintaining access north of the Danube so that they can, it's no longer part of Rome, but we can still go there whenever we want, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Yep. Okay. And then I didn't really know what to say about the Huns, if I was going to talk about them later or just, you know, not say that much about them. Now, the thing I would say about the Huns is, first of all, it's really important to note that they're not a Germanic people. This has come up on the show before. So in World War I, Huns was, or the Hun or whatever, that was used as a racial slur or just a you know, kind of mean slur to the enemy that Americans and Brits and the Allies called the Germans. And then many more. There was a lot of propaganda around that was pretty bad. So just to clarify, Germans weren't Huns at all. Huns were a non-Germanic people from the steppe, from Central Asia, or from Western Asia, rather. And kind of, I would say, my best guess is that they're sort of originated from north of the Caspian Sea? Question mark? I don't really... Would you agree with that statement? Possibly?
It's somewhere around that, somewhere from the steppe.
Yeah, it's again, like, no one really knows exactly. No one, I don't know, I couldn't really find, you know, do people, is, what do we know of their language? Can we order them in linguistically even?
I think they fit into, like, it's not the Indo-European language tree. I think so it's the Uralic family tree.
Yeah,
okay, I think, so, like, Finnish is probably the closest.
So if it was that, yeah, okay.
Remnants.
Yeah, because another thing is I know that they're not Slavic. Because that's, yeah, I do the Bohemian podcast, and we talk about Czechs all the time. Huns were not Slavic, they were not Germanic, so, you know, they were just from that far east. So this completely foreign invasion, and they just rolled in. They just came in right into Gothic territory. I guess, what is now this southern Ukraine, and I was guessing kind of Moldova and Romania and Bulgaria, yeah. That area, and then but heading west. Yeah, so it makes more sense if you don't confuse them with Germans or Slavs, because later that, you know, those are going to be there. But yeah, everyone was kind of fleeing from them, and you know, being pushed along the way.
It's really interesting to think about the origins of the Huns, and like when you think of all these people fleeing out of their way, like you say, we don't really know where they come from. There are some theories that they come from Mongolia, because there's talk of the Hun attacking like Han China.
Yeah. So when I came across this, I found out that the Huns that came into Europe had this cranial deformation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if all had them or if it was a status symbol, but it kind of made them look like aliens. You know, it pushed the back of their head out a bit, and kind of neat looking, but probably very intimidating, you know, if you saw them on a battlefield. And the ones that attacked Han China didn't have that. So there was like a lot of similarities, but maybe it was an off branch of the same peoples, or, you know, it's just, again, really murky.
Yeah. But it's like Mandarin is so like monosyllabic that there aren't many sounds to make, so they can very easily have nothing to do with each other.
Mm-hmm. And then I read that there was the Romans mentioned someone that also was just sounded very similar and probably weren't the Huns. But I can't remember something with CH, and then so it's like, but okay, but by this time in let's say, you know, middle of the 4th century, and then it's 376 when the Goths are really refugees at the border. So by this time we're talking about the Huns, and we know who we're talking about, and even then from archaeological or just kind of, you know, seeing what they had and what they carried with them and their weapons and that sort of thing. A lot of the neighboring steppe things had the same sort of stuff, so it's hard to separate them, I guess, is my point. Like, they used bronze cauldrons. Oh, so did everybody else, you know? So, but in the 4th century, definitely we have them coming into Europe proper now, and like Eastern Europe. And there's one interesting story here I kind of wanted to mention. I didn't really write anything down, so I hope you know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
But when the Goths crossed the Danube, were basically refugees, and crossed the Danube, and then you hear these atrocities of the Romans saying, okay, you know, but it's going to cost you this much money, and you have to, you know, so you have stories of Goths selling their children for a piece of bread. They're all starving, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, that's, I think, in Ammianus Marcellinus, where he writes about that a lot, that the Romans were just awful when just taking in the Goths.
Horrible, yeah. So that's a story I didn't want to, like, completely leave out. So, that's, you know, I wanted to mention that was, you know, a really horrible sort of event. And then, because that made me wonder, like, so what did, you know, they come in asking to be refugees, and then the other thing is that then they all stay together. But previously, refugees came, but the Romans would spread them out throughout the empire, or, you know, mix them up a little bit. But the Goths, you do these horrible things to them, and then you let them all stay together, and now they're inside your border. You know, it just kind of seemed like,
asking for trouble.
Is it really Rome's? I mean, is it the guy? You know, was it the aggressive barbarians at the gates that were, you know, just barbaric and plundering, or were they just kind of out for revenge for what you did first? You know, just kind of, you know, just a different spin on thinking of these old stories that, you know, there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. And yeah, it's kind of interesting that I think as soon as you came in with after these atrocities, then why would you ever think they're going to be loyal citizens? Or
you get that with so many of these stories that they're double-sided, like, oh, the Goths killed the Romans, but then the Goths were also, like, brutally treated by the Romans, and the Goths are also fleeing from the Huns. And, like, the Huns of this, where we imagine them as, like, the terrifying people riding in off the steppe. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, based on all we know about steppe culture, the only time a tribe would ever leave the steppe is if they were forced out by a more powerful tribe. So the fact that the Huns were kicked out of the steppe means that they were the weakest of all the steppe tribes.
Right. There was someone behind them chasing them out. Yeah.
Like, they're, considering how much damage they did to Europe, could you imagine what one of the actually powerful tribes would have done had they decided to leave?
Right. Yep.
It's mind-boggling.
Yep. You know, that also kind of makes me wonder is what, you know, what would have happened if the Romans just would have treated them, you know, brought them all in nicely and then gave them weapons and say, okay, now defend yourselves. And, you know, instead of committing atrocities and making them their enemy. But yeah, who knows?
Yeah. Warsaw.
Yeah. So that's the Danube. That's kind of the eastern part of the Roman Empire and the eastern part of the western, you know, Roman Empire. But on the Rhine, so obviously the Huns didn't just push the Goths. You know, it's just this whole domino effect, basically. And so we also have these invasions on the Rhine in 406. I'll let you just talk about that if you want. That's another great moment I've been waiting for.
I think it's one of like the dramatic set pieces of all history. Like the Rhine freezes on New Year's Eve 406, and then you have like 100,000 Germans crossing the Rhine. It's so poetic.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then that date is kind of a nice marker for, I guess it's often used as one of those landmark markers in the Great Migration period. If you're talking about the Great Migration, thousands of Germans streaming over the Roman border is definitely one of those. And it just kicks off just a whole change of history, and Europe slowly actually kind of becomes more recognizable to our modern day eyes, which there's just all these things happen pretty quickly. We have, I mean, just in the 5th century, we have, you know, Odoacer taking over Italy. And don't worry, this will be a future episode. But, you know, Theodoric taking over Italy, both of them taking it over together. Then this sort of Game of Thrones, like Red Wedding, you know, where just there's this consolidation dinner. And then there's just Theodoric, because he has all of Odoacer and all of his men killed at that dinner. And, you know, in North Africa, we have these kingdoms like ruling themselves in the Roman manner. We have Vandals that are now anywhere near where they're their homeland. They're even they're in North Africa too, right? Vandals.
They
end up in North Africa. Britannia, just, you know, listen to the British History podcast or a History of England podcast. That's well covered there. The Angles and Saxons and Jutes going over there. The East, and this is what's interesting, is that we say this, but yet, you know, the Eastern Empire lurched on, even thrived at times for another 1,000 years. And there's podcasts on that, too. And so I'm not going to cover that at all. But it's just really interesting to note that there's so much chaos here, and the Byzantines just kind of hobbled on and kept going. You know, so then I want to cover the migration period proper, some of the Goths and Huns, the failed German kingdoms, starting with probably the first one was the Kingdom of the Suevi. I think they were kind of settled first and called themselves a kingdom. But the Burgundians were right there. Mm-hmm. And actually, that makes you want to come back on this show, doesn't it? You want to talk about that too, don't you?
Oh, don't you know it?
Yeah, and like slowly I'll make my way to the Franks. So the interesting part is, if you talk about the history of Germany, a lot of the books I have or documentaries I watch or whatever I try to get my hands on, if it's this, you know, huge history of Germany kind of tomb, then it'll start with the Saxons often, or it will kind of, the Franks might be in the introduction, and then that's it. They skip to, you know, Otto the First or the Saxons, and that's where Germany starts. So I already have those episodes written because I've been researching that. I want to make sure I get that right. But that's like, I don't know, 10, 15 episodes from now? I mean, we're not even close yet. So at that point, rather than up until now, it's been a history of the Germanic peoples. At that point, it will be a proper history of Germany. So it's kind of interesting to note. I mean, I started at 40,000 BC with Neanderthals. So it's actually kind of funny that you will apologize to your listeners if you have to skip like 3 months in the Virginia colonies. And I was listening to this and I was like, man, I think I skipped 20,000 years one time, you know? So yeah, I mean, that's I gotta tell my listeners, Jamie is very thorough. I would highly recommend his shows, and it is really interesting to get a glimpse. Right now you're covering the colonies, or, you know, even the early days of the colonies. And it's good to get a glimpse of, on a, seriously, like a month to month basis, what was happening and, you know, who was dying and, you know, the horrible winters and,
everyone dies all the time.
Well, just the utter lack of brains and planning and, you know, hindsight's 2020. Like, I mean, you just mentioned it took them, they were there for decades. This is totally off topic. This is no longer history of Germany, but it took them decades to figure out that New England was colder than the British Isles. Because even though it's further south, you know, you don't have the Gulf Stream and whatnot. So, and I was like, really? Decades? It took them decades to figure that out? But yeah, I guess so. No, interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming on the show. If you want, hey, stop by anytime. I'll have you back on. We can talk about, there's so much more. So if anything, I'll keep going and then I'll have you on to correct all my mistakes and you can...
I'd love to come back on. It's been a pleasure doing this.
That's great. And to the listeners, thank you for listening to the History of Germany podcast. And I will link to all of Jamie's URLs and links to in the show notes. So go to historyofgermanypodcast.com and I'll link to your Facebook page and website and all that. Jamie Redfern's he's also a History Podcast Network member, and so you can hang out with both of us live on the History Podcast Facebook page. We just kick it there. We're in different time zones, so we kind of take shifts. He'll be there, you know, European time. I'm here West Coast time, so it works out pretty well.
Usually find one of us.
Yep, there you go. So, all right. Thank you very much for listening, and join us next time for the Great Migration Period on the History of Germany podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.